Session number 26590.
General Miller, Reel 4. You were telling me about General Ruger and his background.
Yeah, well, but first let me say, when it comes back to the question what he told me about the British having to evacuate and so on, because they had, the air power side, the German air power and all that. I like to put on record, because it's very true, and I remember it very well. There was no sort of criticism in his wording, and I'm sure not even in his mind in any way, that this had to happen. They had come, they had taken what it took. It didn't work out well because of lots of things, like the gladiators and the conditions for British soldiers suddenly finding themselves in the snow. but they had my God, they had losses to have. They had more British fell in Norwegian soil than Norwegians. You know that? Well, you know that, I suppose, but being a historian. But, but there was about 1,800, apart from who fell on sea or drowned in the sea, but on Norwegian soil, and there was much less of Norwegians, about 1,200, I think. So, I mean, one ought to recognize that, and when, you know, voices have sort of ended the situation, and oh, gosh, they're letting us down, they're leaving, and all, there was none of that in Ruger's words and so on. He quite understood that situation. And he just had to deal with the best of it, do the best out of it. When I said about Ruger's place in the army, of course, he was very recognized. I mean, he had been the chief of staff of the army commander, and in fact he was a very able man. He was also a very sober man in his thinking. He was not sort of taken to ideas and so on. He was arresting all these things. As a point of interest, he was the man behind really a proposal to join the two air forces before the war in 1936. But it came out, and before they start dealing seriously with this proposal, the war had sort of come so close to you and the world at home that the climate wasn't for doing it and so on. But anyway, he was the one doing it. But the main thing that affected his position in the army, when I say that he was extremely recognized as a capable and fine and so on, he was drawn into becoming a secretary to the political grouping that really in 1932-34 reduced the armed services to a large extent. And he being a secretary, of course he had to record and do and submit and complain, and partly being able to discuss, I'm sure. But he also had to follow the political directives, however much you dislike them. And I'm sure he disliked them as much as anybody else, or even more, because he knew more about it. But seeing from his outside, they say, oh, Ruger, he was the one who got along with the politicians on doing that reduction and so on. So when he took over command, and this was the 10th of April, up in Elverum, and the 10th, it was the 11th actually, 11th in the morning, there was a lot of army, higher army, sort of saying, oh, Ruger, you know, he was a fellow who sort of let us down in reducing the services and that sort of thing. Highly unfair. And I think that under the climate that he worked in, he did as good a job as anybody could have done, maybe much better a job. So I esteem Ruger tremendously high, I must say that. Personally, I do, in all respects. But that was a point he had to fight with a little. And he probably met the same point when he came up north, and where Fleischer had become quite well known for his sort of stoked, astute attitude and partly success. And Ruger came there with this sort of background that he didn't naturally take the command that he served, probably on top of that. Conjecture from my point, I wasn't there. But anyway,
Do you remember what day it was that you saw, that you had this interview with General Ruger, when he explained to you about...
I would say it would be about the 25th, 26th or something.
Of April.
Of April, yes. Mm-hmm. And then...
How did he have his headquarters set up? Was he...
No, there was no headquarters.
No headquarters. He was in a farm.
Yeah, and what he had inside, how many were there, and so on. There didn't seem to be many people, but I'm sure the government had some sort of other farmhouse. Mm. I didn't see any of them. And we were sitting out on the tram. It was in a warm afternoon. But it was getting a cool evening, of course. And but I remember we were sitting outside, but we were not in the room. And it was quite an experience for a fellow of 22 sitting like that and talking at the time, I must say. I got the... He said, okay, and he said,
When he was explaining the situation to you, the overall situation that the British were having to evacuate and that the fighting in the north would go on to gain time, did he have a map on which to...
He was just talking. And it was quite a while. I'm sure I was there for about an hour.
Yes.
And I'm regretful, really, that I can't remember more in detail. That seems to have disappeared from me.
I was just wondering if you remembered if he said anything about how he thought things would end in the long term or the medium
not
term.
No, when he actually said that he doubted that we could get equipment and get back in time.
Yes.
He does really say a lot of that.
Yes.
That he didn't really think it was a staying affair. I would say that.
It has had a strong implication. He thought that it would end badly for that. So you had your interview with Ruger. What happened to you after that? Presumably you headed back.
Well, I drew back, of course, the same sort of thing. At that time it was colder and the roads were a little better. But anyway, we got back and so on. And I reported to Ewan. And I remember driving back and so on. I was, itching in my eyes. And I thought, well, it's been a long day. I'm getting sleepy or something. But next morning I was snowblind. Because of the day I'd had up in the mountain area, with the cans and all the things, without glasses, and so on. And I was put in a room on that little farm that we had, which was close to the railway station. And it was all made dark. And if anybody has experienced snow blindness, stay away from it. It's awful, absolutely terrible. And any light sort of hitting you like a bomb, And of course they were bombing the railway station just by, so the whole house was shaking. I was lying there, and suddenly the door came up and the light, and I said, get out, or something like that. And then was my brother. My cousin had found him again and said I was funny war.
Was this the station at... where was the station? Was this at Donbass or...?
No, Donbass, a little further.
A little further along.
Lesher.
So you were in a farm near the station at Lesher.
And he came there, and he was trained as pilot at the Vidra civilian company. And he wanted to get across to join the effort, but he didn't want to go to England. He had... wife and child, and he hadn't just seen them, and he said that now he wanted to go up north. And so he got one of the moths that we had, or they had at Lesher. I don't know whether it was actually the one we had it, but he got that one and he flew, but he crashed up at just about where I had first landed, and he was taken prisoner. He came to England later. That's a story in itself. He ended in Canada and he was killed in a flying crash in Canada. But anyway, that was his story. That's the way it went with him. But anyway, it takes that long time with snow blindness. And when we started heading for Ondalsnes to do this, going to England, I was still not well, so I was sitting there on the truck with a vine across my eyes and so on, I remember. And we went off. And we came down to Molde. We came to Ondalsnes just when the when the warship pulled out. And we went on to Molde, and we stayed there. Then I was getting fine again.
How long
it takes about 3 days.
3 days for your eyesight to come back, yes.
It's really it's a growing process. It's a bone that made by the sun, and its healing takes a long time. But anyway, I came to, we came to Molde, and that day when we came, Molde burnt. The Germans had put fire to it, bombing and fire to it. And we got into a house. Next day, we got hold of a fishing boat, and we sailed off towards England. But we got halfway across a fjord. We were bummed out of that boat, and there was one single German airplane going like that, and we were the target, and so on. They got the boat up on the side of the coast of the fjord, and nobody was hurt, but the boat was so hurt we had to get another boat. And we got that, and we started off for England, or for Britain. And we got, fortunately, we got into bad weather. And the skipper, fine man, Remoy, Peter Remoy, he and I were the only ones that went seasick. And you know, when you get down under the cover on a fishing boat, they carry fish, they carry oil and fuel and cod liver. So there were just a reckless people down there. We were about 12 or 14 of us. And we, but I was up on the deck. And suddenly the skipper said that we really have gone too far. Couldn't quite make it out, but we didn't see land. And suddenly we saw a group of ships marshalling somehow, and the warships too, and we were challenged by an eldest land and came up there. But I remember before that, when we saw this out of the mist and on, I ran and opened the hatch and called down to the nearest man, who became a tremendous bomber pilot later, and I said to him that lots of ships, I don't know whether they're British or German, and he just looked at me and I couldn't care less. That's the way it is. But we got a compass from a fellow quartermaster, I suppose. He said we had passed through the Orkneys and the Shetlands.
Presumably then these were British ships that met.
Yeah. They were on the way, actually, when we came to Lervik next morning, earlier, they had taken Iceland.
So
they were marshalling.
Oh, I see. So they were going off for with the 59th Division to occupy Iceland.
So when we got to Lervik, we learned that. But anyway, we got to Lervik, and then the day after, we met the harbour master, we met an RAF representative. We was put on a ship boat called the Highlander, going down the coast. We came to Aberdeen. We were put into Dyce airfield.
Yes.
And we were extremely well received. But British being cautious at the time, after all, you had war for a while, of course they had to check up who we were, actually.
How many of you were there? How many pilots?
We were about 12. They weren't all pilots, but we were about 8 pilots, I suppose, and we were about 12, 13 of us.
Who were the other fellows and the other 4 who weren't pilots?
Well, there was one who came out of a student mass from the foreign service school, and there were one radio operator, there were one navigator, no, there were 2 navigators, the rest, I think, pilots, yes.
Yes.
But we came there and we were taking extremely care of, you know, they showed us a scramble by hurricanes, and we were very impressed, and we had a mess dinner at the evening. Then we had an incident, maybe not of interest to you, but you know, it's so funny how you meet Britain, you know. And there was a wing commander, Queerard, who was in charge. And in fact, I was with the Air Force Academy in London just recently, and we went to see the Ministry of Defence there, and there was a picture of Krira. One of them, he would be in the sort of... But anyway, the Krira was there, and he was a very athlete, and in our group there was a fellow who, to my mind, would have been much more likely to go and see Ruger, because he knew Ruger, but I didn't know Ruger. But anyway, he was in the group, and he was an athlete too. And I remember that as the mess party got on in the evening, and they were extremely friendly, the whole station was just beaming with friendliness, you know. then the Hersberg, his name was, the Norwegian, he stood up on the table and he made a forward circle and stood on his feet, you know. And Krira, he got up on the table too, you know, and made a forward circle, you know. And then they looked at each other, these two, you know, and then they put up a table on top of the table, you know. And then Hersberg, you know, went up on the thing and he made it down. And then Krira just went up there too and did the same thing. And then I remember Hersberg banged him on the shoulder and said, "You are fine, you are champ-fine," which is a typical sort of Norwegian mixture of things. And I suppose what saved the evening was the ceiling, the height of the ceiling or something. But anyway, that was a great evening, a meeting with the Royal Air Force. Then the next day we were invited to a mansion. Do I bother you because
no, carry on.
There's a meeting with me.
Yes, no, carry on.
Next day we were invited to a tremendous castle, mansion, whatever. The husband was a major in the army and he was in Burma. And the lady was residing and being hostess, and she had really laid a table. And when you lay tables, you know, you really, it was, and there we came in our uniforms and so on, that had been going through a month of war and a transfer on the ship. And I suppose we had had a shower or so, but still it was the same clothing. And we looked at this fellow from the Foreign Service, who was a student there, and said, "You were going to give talk for Martin, you know." He must know the... Of course, he didn't need to, but hostesses enjoy it, nevertheless. Mm. But he was sitting there, you know, we were really, and he was sitting there working, and he came up at the end and said, "Thank you very much, we're all fed up." that was I really heard it, you know, it isn't a joke, I've heard it. He even became an ambassador later in life. It was a tremendous thing. Then
you said that they checked up on you very carefully.
Yeah,
How did they do that?
Well, one of us was sent, Ewan himself went to London.
Ah.
And so he could explain to, you know, and the embassy was there, and they could explain and so on, you know.
And you remained behind at base at Dice?
No, you were just afraid there might be some of the Germans in there, you know, spies things. And so. Quite right, too. Mm.
But you were still at Dice while Ewan went. He went down to London. You stayed based at Dice.
So after a couple of days, we came down by train to London.
Oh.
And then, of course, the government hadn't quite arrived. Mm. But Ewan had set up his sort of thing under the regional embassy.
Mm.
And they started, and the Army and Navy did the same thing. And... started going in a sense, what to do now and so on, it fairly soon. And we, of course, pilots at my age, we became rather restless in London, and we could see what...
Where were you actually staying in London at that time?
Well, it was a place called Adelphi Hotel.
Ah, yes.
It's out in Cromwell Road.
Yes.
And we were staying there, and we were admitted as temporarily members of the Royal Air Automobile Club. We had a place to go and swim and do things. And the population were extremely friendly in all respects and ways. But, doing without doing things was hard for at least the age group that we had. And there came in more pilots from up north that came and so on. So we got into a fair amount of numbers, you know. And I, having an army background, was sent up to Dumfries to be a second in command of an army company. We had an army battalion in Dumfries,
yes,
from Stennis, Major Stennis. And he had some company, and I was second in command of one.
Was this a standard rifle company?
Hmm?
Was this a standard rifle company?
Well, it would be. I don't know what you'd call it. What my main impression was that we were sailors, mainly from the whaling fleet, coming back on the way to Norway, and not getting to Norway. They were stranded with lots of money in their pocket. And Dumfries being a small place, they kind of made quite an influence up there. And I was 22, as I said, and was company second in command. I was doing the drilling job and all that sort of thing. And trying to... Well, anyway. They were great people, mature people. You know, just standard. Cooperating, but finding it all, you know. And I remember once it could stop the whole thing. It was rainy and it was miserable. And of course, you didn't have any uniforms enough to go around, and certainly not weapons of any kind. You had to borrow it from... And it stopped up, and then I remember one old timer or so that said, "Oh, don't let's get difficulty." He said, "He's doing as best he can. You know, let's continue." You know, that sort of attitude. And
yes.
They were just kind, fine people. Yeah.
But really, this time you were marking time, weren't you? You were waiting for to do something.
Yeah, I was just sort of bunched off because I had the army back.
Right? Yes,
the pilot. Most of the pilots were left down in London, for example.
Yeah.
Then, of course, the Dunkirk happened, and the business of getting into the RAF was discussed. Some few got into the RAF, started training, actually, just five or six, something like that. I was up there. I got a directive from London at the time to try to find talented and willing people for the technical branch of the Air Force, the future Air Force, which I did a lot of interviewing and so on. There again, sitting as young as I was with these people and so on. But I'm kind of proud of that because we did get a group of mature, discipline-oriented, authoritative people who knew what a trade was,
yes,
and having the age, and what that came to mean for not only building the training camp in Canada, but what it came to mean for the squadrons we had under the conditions we operated under, either at Iceland or on the continent and so on. You know, those mature sort of people, that's unbelievable. And a pilot come and go. And you hear about them and that sort of thing, but these people are just that. And as we got newer people in to be trained in the technical zones, and to have those strong points, that really was a tremendous thing. After the war too, mind you, they stayed on.
How many of those people were from the Air Force as opposed to being mechanics from other backgrounds? What sort of proportion of them were aero engineers?
Well, all these people came, of course, from nursing fleet and from the...
Yes.
So they came from engine room and so on. They were trained in there, so they needed to be trained on airplanes, of course.
Yes.
But we had some who came across from Norway, too. We had a couple with engineering background. Some of the pilots had engineering background, as
yes.
I said.
Yes.
And we had some who were just mechanics at home and came along from up north particularly.
Did any of your ground crew manage to make it from the Air Force?
It wasn't really there. They weren't in the same way encouraged for it. It was the pilots that were encouraged. And that worked both with us in the south, and the same happened in the north. Encouraged pilots to go there.
Yeah.
So that's the way it was. But these people came to mean an awful lot in the Air Force. Awful lot.
Did you notice a change in the mood of the people around you at the time of Dunkirk?
Well, we of course, we did, and it was almost, the decision was made to go to Canada. Mm. It was made mainly on the political level. I would say that Ewan, who at that time became a colonel, Ewan was the head man on the group that I came on.
Yes.
He was influential on it too. He really meant it. We had made a big order of airplanes, American airplanes, before the war, just at the end, before the war came. And we tried to make a base in Britain with these airplanes, but that was impossible for Royal Air Force to take on. Of course, Royal Air Force were up against, they could see what was coming. And Battle of Britain wasn't there yet, but it expected. And they, this was after Dunkirk then. And they couldn't accommodate in that sort of thing. And also they couldn't be dependent on American equipment with a supply line across and all that. So it wasn't possible. But then they tried, I say they, the headquarters, tried to make an arrangement with the French. And they had the P-36, which was the same airplane. You'll find something of this in what I've written to you.
Yes.
But at that time, they were overrun, so that didn't come off. And then the aim was set to go to Canada and make a training base there. And I would say, as a young pilot, you know, in the young group of pilots, active pilot, and the same with the others, we didn't like to go to Canada at all. But we would much rather have gone into Royal Air Force right there. And then, but that was a decision anyway, and it just felt like sort of taking the bucket of water with you when the farm was almost burning, you know, and it wasn't a good feeling at all. But anyway, that was the way. And looking back on it, of course, you can say that was a very lucky stroke.
With hindsight, it was the
right
thing.
Some people would say, oh, how clever they were, you know, to make such a deal. But that is easy to say when the British won the Battle of Britain, but if they hadn't done so, how would we have felt about that, you know? So, in hindsight, you see, we got quicker with the squadrons and quicker in the whole going than we otherwise would have done. But that, I would say, partly luck. Partly luck.